Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fireside room is Bill Strelo. The topic is falling in love with Jesus. So let's listen in on Bill.
This is a week-long session on Jesus and men. By that I mean specifically males. And I cordially invite women to participate in the conversation and the session. This morning we're going to spend some time talking about falling in love with Jesus, or Jesus falling in love with us. And as I said a few seconds ago, what I want us to do is to think specifically about how Jesus and men and Jesus might relate, or what is the allure of Jesus for men. And that can be very, very risky, that can be very, very scary for men to talk about falling in love with Jesus, who is a man. But I want to suggest that that's a useful way of men becoming acquainted with who and whose they are. My name is Bill Strelo. I'm 52 years old. I live in Chicago. I'm a parish pastor. I'm a father to an 11-year-old boy and a husband. And as I said, beginning today, we're going to have a conversation about men. And the reason we're going to have a conversation about men is, as we all know, if we pick up our morning newspaper or we turn on the daily broadcast news and television, we recognize that the vast majority of this world's problems, come as the result of, let's face it, men, males, wars, drive-by shootings in our cities, men in leadership positions in the places where we work who look down upon other men and other women. You can name them as quickly as I can. The world is troubled by some of the actions of most of the men in our country. So we're going to talk about men, and we're going to talk about men and Jesus. What is it about the men who Jesus called that we can model ourselves around and after? We're going to do this talking with the suggestion that the key to mature manhood and the key to mature masculinity is to fall madly in love with Jesus and to become deeply acquainted with and affectionate of the way and the pattern of life that Jesus lived, and as men, as males, to persevere in the life and the sayings and the deeds of Jesus, so that we might be able to do some of those deeds in the world in which we live. And we're going to do this in at least two or three ways. We're going to look at some of the current psychological thinking on maleness that is quite active within our country and around the world. I'm sure many of you have heard the amount of time given to men's studies and men's movements. And the church is becoming very, very much a part of that discussion. So we're going to look at some of the biblical and the current psychological thinking. I want us to spend time with some pivotal biblical texts in and around men, particularly in and around men and their fathers. Today we'll spend some time looking at the story of Abraham and Isaac, and we're going to talk with each other about struggles to be mature males, and that's why I'm glad women are involved in this discussion. Take responsibility for what we are not responsible for. That's going to be a theme of our discussion together, that mature men or mature people take responsibility for what we are not responsible for, or we reclaim our lives. And as a professor of mine once said, that who's also a therapist, works a lot with abused people. Their abuse was not their responsibility when they were small children. But the maturity is when the person begins to take responsibility for what they're not responsible for, to reclaim their lives and to begin to reweave their lives in positive and productive relationships. And one of the most important findings of these pioneers in men's studies, men's psychology, is one, a lost a sense of the sacred, that we live in a society that has lost the sense of the sacred. We are a very secular society. As a matter of fact, a number of years ago, a popular theological book in seminaries was entitled The Secular City, something we should celebrate. But the pretense of the book was that we have lost the sense of the sacred, the sense of the holy, and we've also lost a sense of ritual space, a place that we can go to commune and to learn from God, learn from the holy. And both, it seems, have to do with maturity. If you lose a sense of the sacred, if you lose a sense of God, if you're such a secular society, you lose a sense of maturity. And with maturity breeds transformation. And that is why it is important to recognize and to name the work that we do at a place such as Holden Village. I want to suggest that Holden, over the last 30 years, has developed a sort of mythic quality. It draws people to this mountain, just as a sacred space draws people to it. Holden is a place that we arrive at via somewhat of an epic adventure. Now, we came from Chicago. It took us 2 days to get here. Fly to Seattle, and then you work your way from Seattle to Chelan. We had to depend upon a friend of ours who picked us up at 5:45 in the morning and got us to 25 Mile Creek. It's an epic adventure. And then what do? Seems to me you pick up on the biblical metaphors now as you get to Holden Village. You get yourself into a boat, just as Jesus got himself and his friends into a boat. You sail over this vast body of water, the third deepest freshwater lake in the United States or North America, and you journey to the other side. You journey away from the secular city, if you will, and you get here, and what do? You find a legacy. You find a legacy that is Holden. Holden was a mining place, copper mining place. And so this place, this sacred place, this ritual place, carries on that legacy where people come and we mine the Word of God. We dig into it. We're archaeologists of our lives, and we seek to gain a new purpose for our lives. That's why we retreat to a place such as Holden Village. I want us to begin discussion by my sharing with you some events around my 50th birthday, which occurred 2 years ago. About 3 o'clock in the morning on that particular day, and I had been looking forward to this particular event for some time, recognizing that turning 50 is a milestone. Well, I woke up about 3 o'clock with a series of feelings and thoughts and anxieties. And I sat straight up in bed, recognizing that in some way, shape, or form, I had to get my bearings. That most of my life's years were behind me, yet hopefully a significant number of years of good living, that those years were still ahead of me. And as I shared this with other men, I found that they had had some of the same experiences where they were 50 or 45 or 40. And as I listened to men in some of my counseling practice, I recognized that they too were in a search for getting their bearings. What does it mean to be male? What does it mean to be male Christian in our society? And so as we began to talk about this dilemma, this search for bearings, we began to see, is the Bible in any ways helpful to our dilemma? Can we find men in the Bible who we might point to as men who were trying to get their bearings? And the person that we immediately looked at, the person we pointed to, was Nicodemus. You all know the story of Nicodemus. He probably is introduced to us early in our lives as Christians. He's the man around whom the words, "God so loved the world," were spoken. And Nicodemus was a man searching for, and I think perhaps aggressively, for his bearings. We read about him that his sense of order and his sense of purpose in life, his sense of place in the world, had suddenly been disturbed. As you dive into the text of Nicodemus, you dive into Jerusalem. That's where Nicodemus lived. Nicodemus was an elder within Judaism, one of the keepers of the temple, a Pharisee, who was part and parcel of the instructive element of Judaism. But his sense of order, his sense of purpose, his sense of well-being had been disturbed. As you might recall, in those early chapters from John, there had been a sense of questioning going on in that world. In Jerusalem, there had been riots. Barabbas had led an insurrection in Jerusalem. Jesus had come and upset the money changers in the temple. And Nicodemus, this elder, this wise old man, cannot and could not keep the sense of disturbance to himself. And so what does Nicodemus do? He goes to the one, in other words, he goes to Jesus, who is aggressively disturbing Nicodemus's set way of life. So disturbed and anxious and depressed, Nicodemus seeks understanding and has the most sympathetic and intimate and loving conversation with Jesus. In other words, Nicodemus was our prototype, our example of a man falling in love with Jesus and having a disturbing and anxious and yet sympathetic conversation with the one who represented God, with the one who had been shattering, if you will, Nicodemus's world, opening it up and presenting a different vision, a different path in life. So I want to suggest that males, men and women too, but for our purposes here this morning, that men suffer from what I call the Nicodemus syndrome. The Nicodemus syndrome is marked by restlessness, by longing, by yearning, by questioning, by going in one direction, but then wanting to go in another direction. The Nicodemus syndrome is manifested by sleeplessness, about trying to get one's life together with oneself, with one's wife, with one's children, with one's past and one's future. And that's the manner in which Nicodemus goes to Jesus. This Nicodemus syndrome has to do with our difficulty in handling in a mature way the various aspects of our lives. And I want to identify, I'll take this with me, I want to identify those four aspects or four energies of life as this. There is the energy of nurture, or somehow how we author the life that we live. There is the energy of aggression, in part how we make our mark on the world. And this one obviously is debatable in how we use the word, but it's making a mark on the world. Hopefully without marring the world. I think that's one of the distinct differences in what Jesus was about. Jesus made a mark on the world, but Jesus did not mar the world. The third one is the energy of understanding. Or figuring things out. Pointing ourselves in a new direction, finding a new path that we might walk on. And the fourth one is the energy of intimacy. Or love. That these are the four basic energies or the four basic powers that are within each and every one of us as part of our makeup. Some would say they're part of the hard wiring of the human soul, of the human condition, of each and every person. They're part of the genetic DNA makeup of who we are. And what psychologists are trying to do is decode that. And we look at the story in Genesis about the breath of God. Perhaps we can say, what is it that is breathed into us by this breath of God? And for our purposes today and during the week, I want us to look upon them as authority or nurturing, aggression or decisiveness, understanding or be able to decipher or figure things out, the ability to change our minds, to change our souls, to change the direction of our lives, and lastly, love and intimacy. And of course, various schools of psychology have identified these too. Freudians would say that's the id which drives us. And they're very, very concerned about what these are. But for our purposes, I want to offer up to you that these are gifts of God. And that as we look at them, we might look at them in this way. And this will help us as we find a magic marker that works. This is something I've been talking with Martin Wells about for a week. As we look upon them in this way, nurture, discussion? Understanding? And love. Or to this. We look upon these energies, these God-given energies that we have, as somewhat of a pyramid. That they're all linked together. And that's why this Nicodemus syndrome begins to work for me. That we as people somehow have to work to get these energies together in a mature and a hopefully purposeful way. And that as you look at this, you look upon it as a pyramid, each with four sides. And so you're looking down on the top, from the top of this thing. And each of them then is a triune configuration. And hopefully what we are as human beings is to attain a degree where we're closer to the capstone of the pyramid. But most of the time we spend our energies, we live our lives down here. We'll be doing more of this during the week as we talk about each one of these separately, or we either live on what's called the bipolar ends of these energies. And what we are about as human beings, but for our purposes as males, what we are about is trying to come to a degree of maturity in the areas of nurture, in the areas of understanding, love, and how we go out or reach out into the world. Now, in our world, these energies for men, and we think back to what I said early on, and why is it that such a high percentage of the world's disorders caused by men. That these energies have gone awry and they have gone amok. In other words, men do not know how to use them very well. And the result is war, and the result is abuse. And that these energies, unchecked and unguided, are what feminists have begun to label as patriarchy. Patriarchy, which is an expression of immature masculinity in both the private and the public sectors of life. An immature masculinity that does not welcome expressions of growth and or new life in anyone. Now, those of you who spend time working in an office, perhaps you've had a boss who constantly is riding herd on you. Or maybe you have a neighbor who does the same way. Or you know people who hold at a distance any new expression of life. Or you look at the Bible and what happened when Jesus was born. Who went after him early on? King Herod. King Herod, who had all the power, and to be sure it was an abusive power. But here he goes after this newly born child who he knows in his mind and in his heart wants to have something to do with the recreation of the world. And one of the things that we find in men who are in therapy is that when they start to get better, when they start to see that there's new possibility for themselves, a new purpose for themselves in the world, their dreams take on a new form and they begin to dream of babies. Interesting. that this new life begins to, you know, erupt within their soul, within their psyche, and they begin to dream of babies, but then they also begin to dream on how that child is threatened. And that's why it's helpful to share with them sometimes that story of of Jesus, and how when Jesus is born, Herod goes after him, and Jesus what? Jesus has to be taken to a safe place where he's protected from these abusive powers, a place that provides him the ability to grow and to mature the very energies that we have up on the board. Now, I've come to the realization that one of the reasons that there is so much violence in our streets and in our society by young men, or men in gangs, boys in gangs, what a friend of mine calls monster boys, is that we in North America have lost a sense of eldership. We have lost a sense of mentoring. We have lost a sense of older men caring for younger men and older women caring for younger women. We've become so individually oriented in our society that the role of the older person has all but disappeared. Older folks in our society, and if my parish in Chicago has any thing to say about this, it's that when they retire, and there's nothing they want to do, and they would like to be just left alone to travel. Older people in our society, when they retire, are neglected. Or perhaps they're lured to a place for older adults, like Sun Cities, or you know those places in Florida, California, where they live by themselves, but they have little or no contact with people younger than they are. But in societies in the past, it's that sense of eldership, that sense of mentoring, the role of teacher, the wise woman, the wise man, that has been lost. And remember how the Bible picks up on that. Where is Jesus when he's younger? As a little boy, he spends his time in the temple with the older people, nurturing and conversation with them. I want to suggest to you that in our society, that sense of eldership and mentoring has been lost. And what's been lost is a sense of initiation that is able to move a boy from being a boy to being a man. And I don't know, the movie that I've seen lately that speaks to me most greatly about that is the movie Hook. Did anyone see that movie? It's a modern day version of Peter Pan growing up. It's with Dustin Hoffman and Robin Williams. Robin Williams was Peter Pan, but he left Never Never Land. But then Hook comes back and he captures Peter Banning, that's his name, his children. And in the movie, they return to Never Never Land. And what's happening in there, here's a whole island full of what the maker of the movie, Steven Spielberg, calls lost boys. That phrase is repeated over and over again, lost boys. Boys who have no adult leadership, be it fathers, uncles, mothers, what have you. And in one big scene in the movie where Peter Banning, which is his name, recognizes Peter Pan, it comes because he wins about a 2-minute scene in the movie, argument over where they insult one another. Now those, I mean, you guys know what that means. Who can insult the other boy greater? and it's constantly putting each other down, putting each other down. There's only two left, and the one boy who has been the leader finally can't do it anymore. And he's in despair, he's in distress, because finally this one person has put him down to the degree that he's obviously defeated. How do we move them from boy to man if we do not have this sense of eldership and mentoring that has been part and parcel of any mature society that history might record? Now, what I want to suggest and what we're going to be talking about during the week is the initiation, moving from boyishness, pure masculinity, to the masculinity that Jesus conveys to us in the pages of Scripture, is part of this falling in love with Jesus. This madly falling in love with Jesus and the story that he lives out. And that story, what? It begins with men being called away from toxic situations, who in many ways have become bogus leaders. And what's the story that Jesus has when he calls some of his first disciples? The one that's most prominent to me is when James and John are sitting in a boat with their father. And their father is the conveyor, the teacher of all that is about the society in which they live. And Jesus is walking by and he calls them, "Follow me," and they jump into the water and they leave behind their father. And what I'd like us to begin to think about, that this is in a way what Jesus is doing, is saying, leave behind that which does not nourish or not nurture you very well and follow a different path. Leave behind the lies that you may have been taught about being a man. And as we look at the biblical narrative, almost every episode conveys a way of life that the disciples had been taught and opens them up to a new path of further maturity. Now, what are some of the lies that boys are taught? And the fellows that are in the room now may be able to help me with this. One of them I remember that my father teaching me, and this is a lie, is that big boys don't cry. Have you ever taught that? Or it's a man's world. And I found at 52 years old that that's a lie. It's not a man's world. But my father taught me that. He sat me right. It's a man's world. Big boys don't cry. And children should be seen and not heard. Now, my father taught me that. I loved my father. But he, in many ways, taught me lies. He didn't intentionally teach me them, but he taught me them. Well, it's not a man's world. And I think he would have probably added, even till his dying day, it's a white man's world. But that was a lie. And somehow the story of falling in love with Jesus pulled me away from that lie. So what I want to suggest is that what we as men have to do is to begin to name the lies that we were taught. Like, children should be seen and not heard. Well, when children are seen and not heard, particularly boys, they gather together in groups and they exchange lies. And sometimes those groups become gangs. And sometimes those gangs drive by and shoot other members of gangs because they have to prove what? Their manhood. And they have all sorts of different ritualized initiations that they have to go through. And so we as men, as older men, it seems to me, have to begin to name the lies and of the scary relationships that we may have had with fathers or older men. Now, one of the things that I've noticed just about this energy of understanding and nurture, I don't know if you've seen little Noah Dwyer Voss around here, but just watch him. And he's just a bundle of all these energy. He reaches out for love and to be loved, or he takes daring steps trying to balance himself so he doesn't fall into the little gutters there. Or the other day when we had the dedication of Noah's Ark, here's this little 16-month-year-old, leading everybody onto the ark, and then just standing there, look at me, and everybody's applauding. And I thought of my father, you don't be the center of attention. And yet Noah was the center of attention. And what happens to a person, particularly a boy, when they're told not to be the center of attention? What did they do with all that stuff that's going on inside of them that wants to be appreciated and to have recognition? I think Jesus spoke to that in the disciples, the men that followed him. Or if you want to see some of these energies in action while you're here, just go down to the pool hall and see all these guys trying to play pool. And just the role and the mentorship of Wes Preeb. Wes is, I still think, one of the most unrecognized folks around here in terms of the ministry he has with those boys in the pool hall as they try to take one step beyond their latest victory in terms of relationships. It's an education. Just go down to the pool hall. So Jesus calls us away from patriarchy and to a new life, and shatters the taught world that we have been raised in. Jesus shatters the taught world that we might have had from some of our less productive moments with older men. And Jesus suggests that what we are in need of is eldership and mentoring and initiation into an appropriate way that uses these innate energies, these innate powers, which left untutored lead to chaos and to abuse. So we need leadership and a guidance, and we get that by accessing this story of Jesus and of the men who followed him and felt affection for him. And I got to thinking about this once back home in Chicago when we were doing a little parish survey, or I was reading the results of it because I wasn't the pastor when they did it, and where the men were asked to list their heroes. And over 10% of the men in the church listed John Wayne as their hero. And that struck me. None of them listed Jesus. And I asked myself and someone else, what is it about Jesus that men distance themselves from? Why John Wayne and not Jesus as a person that you want to follow and to emulate? Why is Jesus always thought of as a man who doesn't live in the real world, when in fact the world in which he lived was very, very real, and ultimately that world cost him his life? Why is it that men distance themselves from Jesus? I hope during this week we can begin to talk about that. But the bulk of our work will be looking at each one of these energies that I'm going to suggest to you that are alive with inside of us. Now, some psychologists call them archetypes, other just powers, drivenness. But how do we manage them? When most men don't manage them very well, and that leads to all sorts of abuse and immaturity. Now, to help us in this, what I'd like us to do is to listen to a story in Genesis, Genesis 22, and then I'd like us to talk about it together. And I'll read it. As I said, we're going to spend some time talking a little bit about men and fathers. It's a story you've heard before. After these things, God tested Abraham. He said to him, Abraham, and he said, here am I. He said, take your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains that I shall show you. So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him, and his son Isaac. He cut the wood for the burnt offering, and set out and went to the place in the distance that God had shown him. And so we have these four people, this father and this son, and two servants walking. A father who knows the reason for the walk, and a son who does not, and two servants who do not. So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him and his son Isaac. He cut the wood for burnt offering and set out to the place in the distance where God had shown him. And on the third day, they walked now for 2 days, Abraham looked up and saw the place far away. And so Abraham knew that what he was told to do was coming closer and closer. Then Abraham said to the young men, stay here with the donkey. The boy and I will go over there. We will worship, and then we will come back to you. Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and set it on his son Isaac, and he himself carried the fire and the knife. So the two of them walked on together. I think it's useful for men as they read this story to think about times that they've took walks with their fathers. Because this is a walk with a father, between a father and a son. To dive into the story, it's helpful to think of walks we might have taken with our fathers. So the two of them, the writer of Genesis puts it, the two of them walked together. And Luther has a tremendous commentary on this. Isaac said to his father Abraham, they were walking together, just the two of them, and he said, here am I, my son. He said, the fire and the wood are here, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering? Obviously, Isaac had been schooled in sacrifice. His father had taught him many things. That's what fathers do. That's what the patriarchy was all about. And Isaac, where's the offering? The wood is here. He was a good son. Abraham said, God himself will provide the lamb for a burnt offering, my son. So that question asked and answered, the two of them walk on together. And when they came to the place that God had shown him, Abraham built an altar there and laid the wood in order. And then he bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. And as I read that today, I wonder if there was a struggle. What do you think? Did Isaac simply just say, well, here I am? Or did he fight his father? What does this mean? We're on a walk and all of a sudden you bind me. I'm bound. Did Isaac fight back?
We don't know how old he was, do we?
We don't know. Was he small? We don't know that. But to play with the story, what did Isaac do? Did Isaac fight back? Then Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to kill, or some persons write, slaughter, his son. And what was Isaac about as that knife was raised, ready to come down upon him? I have not found any commentaries that deal with that, with the fear of Isaac. Because the text doesn't take time to deal with that. It says simply, but the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here am I. He said, do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him. And then the ram, of course, is caught in the thicket. And that's how we remember the story. But as I look at the story, it's part of, could Isaac trust his father anymore? Abraham just tried to kill him. But the story doesn't carry that forward. It talks about Abraham's faith. And I'm concerned more with Isaac's fear. Can I take another walk with my father? Or is my father going to try to kill me again? What is this about my father? That he's tried to kill me. I'm wondering if Abraham and Isaac ever had a conversation like that. And I think the story is helpful for me and has been for other men to get in touch with how they might have been wounded by their fathers. For whatever reason, how we might have been wounded by our fathers, and how that might have affected us in the way we live the rest of our lives. So what was Isaac's response to this father who he had been on this walk with that had just tried to kill him? Or what is the thought within James and John's minds and hearts as they leave behind their father and everything that he had taught them about being a man in that society, in order to go in a new direction? And what was Zebedee's thoughts as he sat there now suddenly in that boat and his two sons jump overboard into a new way of life? What's going on in these families? What's going on between fathers and sons? Sons and fathers that speak to the nurturing and the care of these various energies. Could Isaac trust another man, older man again? I think in part that's what we have to be about as we are men in the church. And that's why this falling in love with Jesus and the journey that Jesus takes us on in the management and the care of these various energies, these various potentials that we have, is so important, so that we use them in mature ways and not use them in immature ways. That we become Jesus men and not bogus men. Bogus men, people who use these energies of nurturing to say, it's my way and that's it. They become tyrants. Or they become people who don't want to use energy at all. That's just the way it is. That we become Jesus men and Jesus people rather than bogus folks. When it comes around to using in the right way this energy of aggression and power, how do we use power in a way that's purposeful for the society we live in? And how do we use understanding in a way that leads to inclusiveness? Seems to me that's what happened to the men that fell in love with Jesus. And how ultimately do we love and care for ourselves and one another? Do we do that in a bogus way, in an immature way? A way that lives down here? Or do we find a way through the practice, as I said, of ritual and prayer to move toward a more positive, or the capstone of this pyramid, which has all of these relating to one another. In other words, what does Jesus say about the tensions that exist within men between loving and fighting? Or the tensions that live in men between nurturing and coming to a new understanding of what that nurturing is about. Listening to different ways of practicing leadership.
Doesn't the writer of the story want us to focus on Abraham and not Isaac? Isn't Abraham the archetypal man? I mean, it's his faith that will be celebrated later.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think the writer does, and I always have done that too. But as I read that text again, I'm wondering in terms of the dynamic of the family there, of the relationship, what about Isaac's fear? You know, the faith is there to be sure, but what kind of a faith is it ultimately that would bring a man who loved his son to wanting to kill him, particularly when we see some of that today in various forms and disguises, where our faithfulness to God might mean for us to do this or to do that? And certainly, I think one of the interpretations of this is that the reader, or the writer of the story, is saying there shall be no more sacrifice of the human to please God. I think that's part of that. Dorothy Sola spends a lot of time doing that in one of her writings. But my concern, Martin, is this: the story between a father and a son. And how might that Isaac, or how might any one of us be wounded by our father's best intentions?
The most powerful way I've seen that story portrayed is in art, which collapses the time element into a single scene of a bound boy on an altar. The ram is already can be seen in the mm-hmm. thicket. The angel is already present. The knife is raised, but the angel is present. So the time element which you are suggesting we ought to look at what happened at this moment as Isaac is bound, what happened at this moment as Isaac realizes a knife is over him. What, maybe that's the way we've traditionally dealt with it, is to collapse it into a single scene that doesn't have a time duration, and therefore your questions are, we're not expected to ask your question because we know your questions are irrelevant. We see the knife, but we also see the angel at the same time and the ram in the thicket.
You know, and what I'm asking us to do is to see that from the point of view sequentially of Isaac, and also to say, is this story useful in terms of how fathers and sons might relate to one another? And fathers do something for the best of intentions that the son doesn't understand, that is indeed wounded by. And how do we get into dealing with the woundedness that our fathers might have inflicted upon us and take responsibility for that in order to become more mature? And what happens then with Isaac as his life begins to unfold? And how does he live that life out? And so in terms of just looking at the maturity of boys, and, you know, I look at this in terms of, you know, some of the work I've done with marriage and family therapy and boys that have been raped by their fathers, and how they are afraid of any other male relationship, and then carry that out. Now, not all do that, but the question that I struggle with in terms of mentoring, you know, where is Isaac in all this? I mean, if it's a story of faith, and granted that it is, where is Isaac?
With trying to figure out a paradigm, I understand that in our society, for a long time, there was a sense that in order to be completely a woman, you needed to have that affirmation by your mother, and to be fully a man, you needed to have that affirmation by your father. And I'm wondering if this archetypal thing has not been distorted, because in my own body of experience, and I know that's limited, I see myself as a product of my mother and my father. And I think in some ways there was a powerful balance there. So that when I think of Jesus and his relationships toward women, it was, in a sense, creating a kind of new balance.
Mm-hmm.
Because all the people that came within the scope of Christ were raised up.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if, in our struggle, if we need not get away, you know, like in the secular world, it's the men that run with wolves, or the Iron Man, and the women that run with wolves. And I'm wondering if we don't need to look at something we're together.
Mm-hmm. And I think I appreciate that, and that is exactly where I'm hoping we can spend some time this week, is Jesus opening up a new world. I think you began to put it. And what happens with the, in this case, the men who follow him into that world, where there, as you say, more of a balance, is that in many ways Jesus was tearing apart and destroying patriarchy, or some would say the false appropriation of life. And that every time that Jesus does that, those males have a problem, because he's saying there's a different way to be a male than the way that you were taught by Zebedee. Zebedee's back in the boat and they miss him, But what do they do immediately after they get to the out of the water? As you read the narrative, they end up in suffering. Now, they weren't in suffering in the boat. You know, they were having a pretty good lucrative business because they had servants in the boat with them. But the immediate thing for those men is that they end up in the home of a sufferer. And then they're taken and they meet children. And the learned thing is to, well, keep the children at a distance. And Jesus says, no, that's not the new way. No, listen to the children. That's the lie my father said. Little children, you know, they should be seen, but they're not to be heard. And, you know, and I reflected on that. You know, that's what the disciples did. And Jesus opens up a new way. So what I'm wanting to suggest in this series is that that's what falling in love with Jesus means, is that we as men are opened up and open to the possibility of new relationships. Which bogus leaders would try to prevent. And that opening up to this new space of these new relationships is ultimately what cost Jesus his life. Because ultimately the system wouldn't take it. And that happens time and time again. And the men always got problems with it. You know, even, you know, they get to the point, say, you know, so much has happened, you know, we got to pray about this. And so then Jesus teaches him, you know, what we understand to be somewhat of a radical prayer.